Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. Welcome back to this televised version of the Nowhere Office. I think you know me. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Stefan Stern.
And we're joined today by a very eminent business psychologist. We're joined by Binna Candela of Pern Candela, who's come all the way into London to see us, to hang out with
us. That's great to be here.
We've got tremendous suit envy. We just love what, just to cut straight to the visual element, we love what you're wearing. Sorry if you're listening to this. He's wearing ever such nice threads.
Yeah, I think these things matter.
These things matter. I think it's fair to say, Binna, that you have one of the most accomplished CVs looking at how we behave and feel at work, and with a specialism in the really thorny issues around bias, unconscious bias, racism, and so on. And so thank you very much for joining us on the Nowhere Office.
Very honoured to be here.
Long overdue, Stefan, I think that we've actually talked about these issues. We haven't really had a dedicated programme to diversity, inclusion, specifically.
And now we've got a chance in the context of the Nowhere Office and the future, the hybrid future, to ask you, Binna, what do you think we learnt during those lockdown times? What emerged about people's experience of work and the workplace, good and bad? And what can we build on now we're here?
What can we build on? Yeah, I think the main thing that emerged after lockdown was that actually people like working from home if they have the opportunity. I think before lockdown, something like 12% of people were working from home. It almost quadrupled by the time COVID happened. And something like three quarters of people now, it's a very high number, actually would like to have the opportunity to work from home if they can have it. And people are now talking about hybrid working. So I think that's the biggest change that's happened.
Is that then the biggest psychological shift, would you say, across the workplace?
In terms of people being able to work from home.
And wanting to.
Yeah, I think there are implications of people working from home, which are also psychological, which kind of need to be acknowledged. But that, in overall terms, that's the biggest shift that occurred. Yeah.
And in terms of colleagues who are either from an ethnic minority, and also it's not even a diversity question, it's just the question of women at work, which is in the majority. It's not a diverse question. What did we learn? What did people say? Have survey data revealed anything about their experience, the benefits that some people experienced?
Yeah, when you look at diversity and lockdown in particular, we were actually carrying out some research which started in November of 2019. And it was nothing to do with COVID. I hadn't even heard of COVID. I hadn't heard of furlough. And we were going to follow this group of people up 6 months later to kind of say what was impacting on their well-being. So we were just kind of handily placed. So when lockdown happened, we could actually say this was the way people were feeling before and this is the way they're feeling after. And there were all this commentary that was going on that, you know, minorities are more likely to die of COVID. And then there was this kind of uninformed commentary that minorities, ethnic minorities, must feel worse from working at home. And our data didn't show everybody felt worse. Right? Everybody felt worse. But minorities felt less worse than everybody else. And when we followed this up, the people were saying, actually, I've got far more ways of kind of getting involved and interacting now than I ever had. If I'm at work, you know, my colleague could actually, I might not even be in their line of view. I could be sitting behind them. I now have ways of participating in the conversation. I take up an equal amount of space on the screen. And if I want to speak, there's different ways I can do it. I can put a cartoon hand up.
I found that in my research for the book, The Nowhere Office, that people from an ethnic minority background said that they felt safer with less microaggressions and that they felt a certain sort of equality. And I certainly remember thinking that that was an important byproduct. What do we do now that people are sort of back? What are you finding now?
If I can just go back to the research, the group that was most affected by lockdown negatively were women.
Right.
And this was during lockdown, remember? I'm not talking about hybrid now, I'm talking about lockdown itself, and particularly mothers. they were the ones that their whole kind of their sense of their identity just kind of went right down, because all of a sudden you're in the home, the schools are closed, remember, and what came to the fore is you're a mother, you're not a colleague, you are a mother. Your responsibilities are to their family.
The double shift or the triple shift even.
Yeah. And so this notion of their identity, I have a professional identity, was then kind of subsumed by your kind of your responsibilities to your family and your household. And as a consequence, that went down more than any other group of people.
So how many people are we talking about, actually, when you say you did research?
This was before and after. There were several hundred people. We lost a number of people, obviously, because people who did the first survey didn't do the second one. But we're looking at 300-400 people.
And so there was a sort of motherhood penalty, as the academics like to call it, that their identity was eroded and therefore their well-being, their psychological state.
Interesting. Yeah. That's different from hybrid working, but it's something that we need. It just shows that, you know, beneath the surface, it's not hard for these kind of associations to be triggered.
So are clients now asking you for advice on how to, you know, embed more civilised, more flexible, more humane working practice, you know, a healthier workplace in the hybrid context? Is that the sort of thing that they want to hear?
Partly, but it's more about how can we achieve inclusion?
Right.
In this hybrid environment that we now have, how can we achieve greater levels of inclusion? So hybrid is obviously a combination of working online and if you have the opportunity to do that, and being in the workplace. Men are actually, this is not our research, this is from colleagues of mine at Leeds University Business School, have found that men actually feel more comfortable being in the workplace than women and minorities do. So this is a massive piece of research.
So white men, you're saying?
Yeah. So we've got to find a way of making this work so it fits everybody, so everybody can.
Well, that leads me to the question, could we just sort of helicopter out a minute and say, what do you mean by everybody and inclusion? What does success look like? What's the field that you're in, really? Could we just sort of go to the basics, if only for my benefit?
Well, people talk about diversity and inclusion. Somebody came up with a lovely kind of phrase about diversity and inclusion, is that diversity is about the about counting the numbers. Inclusion is about making the numbers count. Mm-hmm. It sums it up quite nicely, actually, that whilst diversity is seen as being about representation of different identities in the workplace, inclusion is more about how you feel. Do you feel valued, respected? Do you feel like you have a contribution to make and it's being recognised? So it's one's more about, one has become to mean like a statistical measure. The other one is more about the emotional engagement that people experience.
So this leads on to this other hot topic, controversial topic, I think, in my opinion, much misunderstood topic of unconscious bias, as it is known. What do you think unconscious bias is, in as much as it exists, and what can we usefully do about it?
Yeah, it does exist, and it's been taught. There's this commentary that some people have, and it's quite eminent people have, said that unconscious bias just doesn't exist. In which case, thousands of years of philosophical teachings are wrong. You know, a Buddha was talking about he didn't use the term unconscious bias, but he was talking about these things thousands of years ago. And it does exist. The definition I like is that it is a misleading cognitive tendency. So it's a way of thinking that leads us to the wrong conclusion. And I like it because it's only three words and it sums it up quite nicely. And an unconscious bias, therefore, is a misleading cognitive tendency that we don't even know that we have.
But there seems to be a problem in the market, if I can put it that way, in that there's some data, some people argue, shows that some of the interventions by some training companies, they might not be psychologists like you, and they call it unconscious bias training, and some of the outcomes seem to have been disappointing.
Yeah, well, there have been things written, actually, by some quite serious-sounding people, and which kind of show that unconscious bias training doesn't work. The nudge unit at the in the Cabinet Office being one of the most prominent. My wife actually went through this report and went through all of their references, all the stuff they studied. And some of those papers they referenced actually weren't the studies they quoted weren't even about unconscious bias. Some of the measures they used were inappropriate. So actually, you kind of take It's a form of unconscious bias in itself, actually. The nudge unit, cabinet office, 10 Downing Street, it must be reputable. Mm. And then she went through them. Actually, she did a webinar on it, and it's actually just pulling this thing apart. Actually, they reached a conclusion before they did the research. And so they read papers which had nothing to do with unconscious bias, which measures were inappropriate, and then they reach this conclusion, which then gets quoted, you know, time and time again.
But surely, in addition to context, Binner, it's execution. Mm. And surely there is a risk that by helpfully commodifying problems and issues that need to be addressed, they can be unhelpfully implemented. Mm. And I think we do know, at least anecdotally, that quite a lot of distrust and resistance was stirred by the idea that unconscious bias training needed to become mandatory and widespread. Mm. I certainly struggled with that idea, to be honest with you. It's not that I think I'm in any way, without bias or flaws myself, but I feel I'm a bit more in favour of a more direct approach. Mm. You and I talked about this beforehand. So the very long-winded way of saying, was it a bit the law of unintended consequences that the concept of unconscious bias went out there and then just as quickly created problems?
Yeah, and it creates problems because some people who are kind of coming up with the solutions actually aren't basing it on research. And
they're not good enough.
They're not good. Yeah, right. The interventions aren't good enough. Yeah.
Stefan, you gave me a slightly worried podcast husband look when I started to go down that road. I mean, do you share that view that there was unintended consequences of unconscious? What would you think about unconscious bias when it was introduced into the market, as you say?
Well, I think Binner's point is very important that, bad training will lead to bad results. Mm. Just as how many billions of pounds and dollars have been spent on leadership and management training? And what have we seen at the end of that? So that for me doesn't prove anything about unconscious bias. It seems to me unconscious bias is a very useful catch-all phrase to consider some of the things that Binner's talking about, things that we aren't necessarily consciously aware of, the assumptions that we have. And I think some of us need to be introduced to them in a friendly way.
Binner, what is the ideal way to confront unconscious bias in the workplace or in a workplace? Let's bring this to specifics.
I think the ideal way of dealing with it in the first place is actually just look at the words, the language that we use. Why did it have to be confronted? When after George Floyd's murder and the discussions about racism in the workplace, there was this kind of language is being used that people need to be called out. Why can't you just give people feedback? I mean, why do they have to be called out? Because that suggests something quite strong. And why can't they just be told, actually, we give them feedback? So the language we use is actually quite conflictual, I think, even in terms of how we deal with it. And the other thing we need to appreciate, when you start looking at a topic like bias in the workplace and how people are treated, you kind of have victims and people who are on the receiving end of this, and you have perpetrators, people who do it. And then you have bystanders. Mm. And I think those people who are kind of saying, yeah, there's no such thing as unconscious.
That's the classic coaching model, isn't it?
Yeah.
The victim, perpetrator,
bystander.
Bystander, right.
And then I think what most people say, unconscious bias doesn't exist. It's all deliberate. There's no such thing. They actually see themselves as either being the victim or the bystander. They never see themselves as being the perpetrator.
Right.
Because by definition, if you're not conscious about it, how do you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But what does the end game look like in terms of a workplace that has more harmony than less, that is more productive than less? I suppose a critic of these new terminologies would say we're going down a rabbit hole.
Because
we're not getting nearer to reducing the conflict, we're only creating more avenues to identify it.
And they could have a point.
Right.
Because actually, diversity in and of itself, right, people talk about, the advantages of having a diverse workforce. The research on this is actually quite It's double-edged. There's some research which showed that diversity is a good thing in the workplace, and other research that diversity is a bad thing for the reason you're raising, Julia.
Diversity itself, sorry, diversity initiatives. Is that what you mean?
No, diversity itself.
Really?
You don't get the benefits of a diverse workforce unless you're also inclusive.
Right.
Because the type of tension that you're referring to, if there's not a sense of inclusion, actually what it leads to is the worst type of conflict in the workplace, which is interpersonal conflict. Hmm. The best type of conflict is actually where we disagree on how to do something. So you think we should do it that way, I think we should do it that way. Actually, we still respect each other and we talk about it. We thought, actually, the best way is probably this. That's good. That's productive. But if you're going to say, you're that and I'm a this, I can't stand you, that's the worst. That actually, without inclusion, where you think he is that.
Mm. The othering.
Yeah.
Who coined that phrase, othering? Stefan, I bet you know.
I don't know, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, could a listener...
Could
a listener share with the group who came up with that? Because it is, isn't it? It's making an enemy or an other rather than...
Of your colleague.
Yeah.
Yeah. So diversity without... So inclusion, whether you have diversity or not, the research is quite clear. Whether you have diversity or not, inclusion is always a good thing.
And when did equity come into the mix? Because we've got all a bit lingoed, haven't we?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how these things... It's a wonderful thing, how language develops, and these phrases. Because when I started...
Equal ops.
It was equal ops, yeah. It wasn't even equal opportunities, it was equal ops.
Equal ops.
We had equal ops managers, not directors. We had equal ops. And then it became diversity, and then it became diversity and inclusion, and now it's become diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Because, I mean, one thing that I'm struck by is we're recording this in a very particular time, and very recently, a colleague of mine at Bloomberg, Merin Somerset Webb, wrote a coruscating piece saying, ESG is over. And ESG is over because inflation is making life so difficult for organisations that all the niceties of purpose and blah, blah, blah. But she also sort of makes the point, I hope I'm not misquoting her, that you know, by the time you're labelling these things, they might risk being sort of out of date. It is interesting, isn't it? D&EI or D&I or the new languages.
It's never D-I-E, incidentally.
It's never D-I-E. But you know, ESG, are we going to end up with a sort of, apropos die, a graveyard of terminology?
Alphabetti spaghetti.
I don't think so. I think it's just the way things progress, isn't it? The conceptually, in my own mind, things haven't changed. You know, we were talking about equal ops. Mm. Things haven't changed. You know, we were talking about the same things then. And equality kind of disappeared, didn't it? It became diversity, inclusion. Now it's equity. Well, psychologists have their own meaning of what equity means.
Right.
But
But I think that comes back to this concept that unconscious bias really, to use a British phrase, narked people. Mm. It really threatened people. The idea that you have no agency at all over whether you are being difficult, rude, unfair, uncollegiate, needing to be challenged, that someone else can tell you you're at fault, whether you intend to be or not. So I think the language does matter, even if the fundamental underlying thoughts behind it have stayed the same.
Hmm.
I think unconscious bias, I'm not sure, is a helpful term, but don't hate on me, as the kids say.
Well, I think Binner's point was it depends how you have the conversation.
Yeah.
It depends how you discuss the challenges. But we all, you know, it's a sad fact of life that we don't always know what we don't know. And we have things have to be pointed out to us.
Yeah.
And I think if you are in a position, let's be blunt, if I'm a bourgeois, white, middle-aged guy, I've got a lot of advantages in this society. I still do. But I might not realise it. I might not realise the advantages that I've got when I walk into a workplace or some other organisation.
But in a workplace, isn't the object of the exercise to say your behaviour, your words, your actions have this effect that is impeding or inhibiting or being unfair. Mm. Adding on to it the idea that you might not even know it is rather threatening to somebody and doesn't necessarily help them.
Well, I'd see it the other way around, actually, is that do you realise when you said that it had this impact on this person?
Right.
And then I say, you say to me, you said that to Stefan. No, you wouldn't. Stefan would say to me, you would say to me, you said this and it made me feel like that. I would appreciate it if you didn't do that in future.
Yeah.
And rather, you know, did this instead. And then it's for me to say, oh, thanks for that. I didn't even know.
Yeah. So unconscious bias, let's not overthink it, really, is what you're saying, is that the output is that there's a more enlightened air about the place.
And you didn't, and you won't have mentioned unconscious bias to me at all. You'd have said, you said this, it made me feel like that. In future, if you could do that, I'd really appreciate it. And I go, well, that's my first response, actually, typically my first response when I told these things, oh, don't be so silly. and then a day or two later, I'll go, oh, yeah, you got a point.
That's interesting. So there is an inbuilt, because that makes sense to me. There's a sort of time delay.
Well, Dan Pink just said the other day, actually, advice is better than feedback.
Yeah.
Advice is better than feedback. Advice you can act on.
Daniel Pink.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Feedback is just something that feels like, it can feel like a telling off. I know we joke in HR world, we say feedback is a gift, but we always say it with a smile because actually we know we all hate it. We all hate feedback in the first instance.
I think you've said something really super interesting because it actually makes me think without wildly oversharing about my husband, which is in a marriage, if I can generalise, sometimes you say something or they say something to you and it really goes down badly and all the defence mechanisms go up. And then you notice that you are, in fact, hearing it and acting on it, or they are. Mm. But there's a time delay.
Mm.
But in a sort of committed relationship, it's a safe space, isn't it? In the workplace, things often feel very unsafe, don't they, Binner? Mm. So how does that work when there's a conflict and someone is raising something really, really real, really difficult, and they might not be as invested as you are with your long-term partner?
Yeah, I think... It's a great question, and I think that I think we need to appreciate actually that the biggest bias that anybody ever has. I mean, there's countless research studies that show this. The biggest bias that anybody ever has is a self-serving bias, or it's this egocentric bias. So I am a better 80% of Britons think they're above average drivers. The number of people who smoke who think they won't get, I know smokers are more likely to get cancer, but it won't happen to me.
Optimism bias.
Yeah, it's kind of that, but it's also this self-serving bias. We're better than we think we are. We're working with a group of very senior leaders in a bank, global bank, 200, and we asked them on inclusive leadership, where do you think you are compared to your other 199 other colleagues coming on the programme? Are you below average, average or above average? 100% said they were above average. And when you present it back to them, they laughed. And it kind of makes the point.
Yeah.
You know, they get it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to hammer the point home. But it's so this reaction is kind of, how dare you? Because I'm better than most people on this. So why don't you look at yourself rather than kind of pointing the finger at me? It's a natural reaction.
That is so interesting. I'm reminded, apropos that, of the Microsoft research around attitudes to hybrid work. Do you remember it scandalised everybody that 80% of managers in, I think it was their 2023 survey, said they felt that their employees just didn't work as well if they were out of reach, unsupervised, unmonitored. And 80% of workers said, we're doing great. So there was that, asymmetrical...
Yeah.
Affirmation bias. Can we talk a little bit about the enlarged sense of psychology in the workplace, which is events in the world? We're recording this episode in the middle of October, a couple of weeks after the terrorist attack in Israel and the subsequent retaliation by Israel in Gaza. Mm. Very dangerous moment for the world. The workplace we know now is already getting involved. There's been firings from banks and universities where people have, you know, not shown their unconscious bias, shown their absolute bias and so on. I mean, is that a new phenomenon or is it getting worse? What's your feeling about the out there world and its impact on the psychology of the workplace?
Yeah, the world is getting better. There are events which happen which kind of makes it seem like things are getting worse, but generally speaking, the trend is for more inclusion and more tolerance in the workplace. But then these events occur; we've got to manage them. I think one of the things that we've got to learn to do better in organisations, and this particularly became noticeable to me actually when after George Floyd's murder, all of a sudden organisations wanted to have conversations about race. And it felt like we didn't know how to have that conversation, and we kind of need to have, before we have the conversation, we need to have a conversation about how we have the conversation. So we need to talk about how we're going to talk about this before we launch into having a conversation. And one of the things I've kind of, there's an expression I really like, actually, speak as if you're right, listen as if you're wrong. So actually express your views, because we want people to express their views. Mm. But be mindful of the fact there's a diversity of opinion in this room. So be respectful, but also listen and be prepared to learn from other people. So there needs to be this sense of kind of a set of rules we need to have in place, which everybody agrees to abide by before we have a conversation of this type.
It sounds a bit like Amy Edmondson's discussion of psychological safety. The workplace should be a safe place. But that requires us all to behave thoughtfully.
And civilly.
Carefully, civilly, yes. Yeah. I mean, in a way, old-fashioned manners would help, would get us quite a long way. But that's the concern, that we seem to be struggling. Of course, social media on the whole doesn't help in this. We seem to be struggling to have calm, civilised, constructive conversations.
Yeah, but we can have them.
But what, I mean, look, there were probably diverse views even about George Floyd's murder, but equally it was quite a unifying sense of outrage and an outcry. The events in the Middle East are not actually unifying. Mm. And so you've now got a situation where, you know, different demographics, different self-identified and actual racial groups are saying one thing in one workplace, which is in direct contradiction to others linked in, which is normally quite a benign, unpolitical place, and suddenly become pretty open and full of statements. If you were, surely you're going to get an influx of crisis D&I consultations out of this, aren't you?
We haven't had anything yet.
And aren't you going to expect it? Interesting.
I don't know, to be honest, Julia. I really don't.
Oh, I love someone saying I don't know. We should have a whole program to not know.
I should come back then.
Definitely.
You need more than 25 minutes. No, I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. It may be that this is just such a sensitive topic. And like you said, it was unifying. There was a sense of people coming together with that, with George Floyd. I think one of the things you can usefully talk about, though, is just don't just stereotype people because of their religion and their faith. And I think that's the worst thing that can happen out of this. Whatever you think about the politics of it, in the UK workplaces, being anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, it's just kind of, that's not, you know, we can have a discussion about, I'm not sure I'd be qualified to have a discussion about Middle East politics, but I could have a discussion about prejudice and, you know, prejudice based on people's faiths.
And just feelings. What was that wonderful thing you said a moment ago about
speak as if you're right, listen as if you're wrong.
I think that's completely wonderful.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to some degree, people, I think, expect they have to be certain and completely in one camp rather than another.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Whereas I think what we're discussing is actual tolerance. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what the mix of diversity and inclusion is? Stefan, are you as sort of neutral to optimistic as Binner is about the Middle East in particular? Because I think it's, in my experience, quite a new event in terms of workplace politics. Mm-hmm.
I think it will depend how long this all goes on at this level of intensity and how complicated it gets. My concern would be slightly different. It's just that in a hybrid world where there's less what we're doing now, sort of, you know, FaceTime, flesh time, that gets even perhaps more complicated to manage. Mm, mm. And online, things could go wrong very, very quickly, just with a thoughtless little comment in a chat room or whatever it is. Mm. And so I think from a management point of view, it's just got even a bit more complicated, potentially. There are advantages, as you were describing them, of hybrid, but there's just so many layers to it now in terms of our relationships and interactions that we just have to, I think, we just have to be even a bit more careful sometimes.
And I think if you're choosing, let's say something did happen in the workplace, and you're kind of saying, look, we need to address this, we need to talk about how we relate to one another and how we engage with one another, that would be better done, getting people into rooms together rather than doing it online, because it's so sensitive. And being able to, you know, kind of talk, see your colleagues and face them, and you can get more civil behaviour, I think, and more people engaging with it, potentially, as a consequence. But it's so sensitive, I'd hesitate to do that online.
Yeah, I'm a little bit unsure whether this new phase that we may or may not be entering, where global geopolitics is colliding with individual identity politics, which is what I think is happening, isn't going to really sort of challenge the mainframe of the way HR and by association diversity and inclusion isn't constructed. I mean, if we think about it, we're only just getting over quite a tense period where, you know, the pronouns you used at work dominated a lot of airtime. You know, if you like, identity politics 1.0, whereas if you're going into the identity politics of, you know, families and race, that could get really very, very tense.
Yeah, if it moves to that degree of intensity, I think it could. But I think also there's a tendency within diversity and inclusion policies and for the policymakers themselves just to kind of grab hold of an idea that this is what we're doing. So pronouns would be a great example of that, without actually kind of choosing to look at and so what are the consequences of doing this. And should it be mandated that everybody's got to put, which is actually what organisations were doing a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, they were being told, you have to, everybody has to, without really kind of thinking, well, there are consequences of doing this. And are we fully aware of what those consequences are?
I mean, Stefan, I always think, is rather rebellious in that he always wears pink headphones when he's doing our audio interviews by Zoom, as if to say, do not define me. It's a sort of pronoun headphone etiquette. But
it's more Freudian, because they're my daughter's One Direction headphones, so it brings me closer to her in a way through the ear. So it makes me listen to her better, because I'm using her headphones.
All right. Yeah.
But I sense, and we're going to wrap, sort of unfortunately have to wrap this up, and we're going to end in a minute with what do you do when you're not working. But I don't know you very well. You know each other better. But I sense you're sort of a very calm, stabilising force, but also a tiny bit radical. Like, you're not afraid, are you, to say, well, just because everybody else is going down that road, do we have to? Do you often give advice that surprises your clients?
Maybe, yeah.
Big pause there, Dr. Freud. Let's do that one again. Binner, are you a radical?
Am I a radical? I don't think so, because I look at what the research says, I look what our research says, I look at what, if you follow the logic of an argument. So what pops out is kind of, if you go down that line of argument, actually you end up there, and that's not where you want to be. You kind of want to be there, so actually be better off doing that. So if you look at the research that's been carried out, the research that we do, and you just follow the light logic of an argument, so it doesn't come out, I don't feel radical, I just kind of feel it's logical. But I'm very happy to be called radical, but I would never call myself that.
So, but do you mean you're a sort of follow the data kind of a guy?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Yeah, that might actually sound like the Prime Minister.
You are, of course, Binner Kandola OBE. So there are limits. There are limits to your radicalism. I'm the only one in the studio without an OBE. What am I doing wrong?
A few more seasons of the Nowhere Office.
Okay,
Stefan,
we'll be there. We'll be
I'm
there.
Sure you're, yeah. you will be recognised for your considerable achievements to
Thank
the workplace.
You. Thank you.
But can we talk about what we do when we don't work? Because that's what we like to do with our guests as well. Is like, is your head full of work? When we were chatting outside the studio, you said, oh, I'm reading an interesting book about my next book, which I think I'm allowed to say is about LGBTQ+ in the workplace.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are you just consumed with work and work ideas, or do you switch off? And what does switching off look like?
Yeah. No, I switch off. The EastEnders.
Oh, really? Soap opera?
Well, EastEnders.
You're from the Midlands. Yeah, that's exotic to you because you're from the Midlands. Yeah. Cockneys. Yeah.
For our overseas audience, yeah. EastEnders is a very famous British soap opera. And so there's a sort of inside the belt way.
Well, this time last year, two years ago, we watched the Christmas edition of EastEnders in March. And then last year, I said, we're not doing that again. And so last year, beginning of October, in order to get the Christmas edition on Christmas Day, we had to watch 16 episodes of EastEnders a
Commitment.
Week.
Commitment.
A week?
And we did it with 2 days to spare. That's one of my proudest achievements.
totally focused.
But, yeah, but switching off, and actually our daughter plays cricket, and so that takes a lot of time. Mm. I know, like going to the theatre, and saw something fabulous that kind of connected the LGBTQ. There was a wonderful production of a new play at Stratford-upon-Avon at the RSC called Cowboys. And that was all about gender nonconformity and mm-hmm. And how you can express yourself through your clothing as well. You know, it was part of it was brilliant.
Actually, a workplace-ish mass entertainment programme I've been watching is the Beckham Netflix documentary. And the first episode is about the tensions he had with his manager, Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United. I should qualify by saying I'm a totally football-free zone. I'm not remotely interested in football as such. But it was just an interesting depiction of tension with your teammates.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're very good at actually completely switching off.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I get consumed by things. But things just happen, and then you just have to switch off. You can't. Children,
get off the internet.
They kind of require you to
put the phone down,
pay attention,
and talk to people. Yeah, definitely.
Well, it's been a real treat to have you. I'm thinking it's a Paul Smith suit, but maybe it's not a Paul Smith suit. Where's your suit from?
It's from a Leamington tailor, actually.
A tailored suit.
It's a Clements Church. I think they're based in Birmingham and they've got a branch in Leamington.
Listeners, it's sort of grey with a tiny little bit of blue piping. Mm. And Stefan is looking at it. His tongue is basically hanging out at this point, isn't it? But, look, that is all we've got time for. Maybe that was my unconscious bias. I do apologise. Maybe that was my bias that you had envy and you don't. I feel I've learnt a lot today. And I'm going to keep thinking and learning about this question of unconscious bias. And for me, my big takeaway, I don't know about you, Stefan, has been the point that Binner made about the time it takes between being told an uncomfortable truth and absorbing it and acting on it. Mm. I think that is a really hard thing, isn't it? Mm. Especially when you're not in a sort of forever situation like one is more at home than in a workplace. Stefan, what has stood out for you from this discussion, other than suit envy perceived or actual?
Well, I think it's this need for reasonableness. Mm. And reasonableness is getting squeezed out, and reasonableness gets shouted down and gets threatened. And we've just got to be better at listening to each other, I think. Mm. We've got to be better at speaking, as you say, speaking thoughtfully, but really listening to people, really listening to what they're really saying, giving people time and space to say what they really mean, because sometimes they might not get around to it straight away. Mm. So I just think it's complicated. People are complicated, and this is complicated. And that's why management's so hard. That's my uplifting thought.
Mm. And what an uplifting thought that is. Well, that just remains for me to turn to our camera, directed by lovely Ed behind the glass panel, and to say, if you're watching, thank you for watching The Nowhere Office with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is a fully connected production, and you can find us in all the right places, on X, on LinkedIn, Spotify, Apple, etc., etc. And it just remains for me to thank our wonderful guest in the studio, Binner Candela of Pern Candela. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been an honour being here.
This has been a fully connected production of The Nowhere Office, which can be found both here on YouTube, but also on LinkedIn and X, and on all the audio platforms you might expect. And I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Stefan Stern.
And thank you to our production team, Spiritland in London, with Ed in the studio and Kevin in Miami on audiovisual production. Thank you.